Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the National Multiple Sclerosis Society Top 10 List of MS Questions Conference. Your host, Ms. Amy Watkins, will now begin.
Good evening, everyone. This is Amy Watkins from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, and I would like to welcome you to tonight's teleconference, the Top 10 MS Questions. Our speaker is Dr. Angela Appleby, Director of the MS Center of Northern New England at Fletcher Allen Healthcare. Dr. Appleby will answer some of the most frequently asked questions about MS. Participants will have an opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. The operator will instruct you how to do this when it is time. Thank you so much for being here with us tonight, Dr. Appleby. I'm going to turn the call over to you.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks for calling in tonight. I'm going to cover the top 10 questions I've gotten over the last month in our MS clinic. And I'm going to start with number 10, and these all range from patients that are newly diagnosed to people that don't have MS yet and have something called a clinically isolated syndrome. So the first question is, what is an MS relapse? This is a real common question I get, especially from people that are newly diagnosed, because when you're newly diagnosed, initially it's hard to tell what is MS and what is not. So a relapse is any new symptom that's not been previously present and is present for a steady 24 hours. So, and in general, a relapse is categorized from another relapse, meaning one relapse can be a 30-day period. So we always say relapses are separated from a previous relapse by at least 30 days. So one relapse can last for 30 days. An example would be if someone came with blurred vision of their left eye on a Monday, and on Wednesday started to notice numbness of that side of the body. That's one relapse, versus someone that has optic neuritis of the left eye on a Monday, and then 3 months later has numbness of the right leg. That's two separate relapses. It's very normal to overanalyze symptoms early on in the diagnosis, and I always tell patients, if you're worried about anything and you're wondering if it's MS, just call and we'll sort through it together. The biggest thing that I get the calls for that aren't relapsed is something called a pseudo-exacerbation. You'll see that on the handout if you have it in front of you. It's a recurrence of an old symptom. So basically, if a patient has numbness of the right side of their body and then gets better and a few years later starts to notice the same symptoms return, that is called a pseudo-exacerbation. And the most common reason that someone has an exacerbation like that can be fatigue, where they haven't gotten as much sleep as they usually do, an infection, or stress. And so if you can find the underlying cause and treat that, these symptoms themselves go back to how they previously were. So a relapse is any new symptom you've never had present for 24 hours. The next question I commonly get is number 9, and that's, how do I tell if I'm having a good response or to my therapy or if it's suboptimal? Meaning, how do you tell when you should talk to your doctor about possibly changing your therapy? And there was a nice consensus statement put together initially in 2002 and then in 2008, where we look at MS patients in three different ways to see whether or not their therapies are working. One is their actual relapses. Two is whether they're progressing on their examination. And three is by following the MRI. So first, in looking at relapses, when a patient comes in with a relapse, we grade them low, medium, or high as far as how severe their relapses are. A low relapse would be something like some subtle sensory changes on one side of their body or some subtle blurred vision that's not to the point where you are having a significant change in your ability to read. A medium relapse would be something like you're having difficulty walking, your coordination's affected, or you're possibly noticing that you have blackness to one of your eyes. These medium relapses tend to be needed to be treated with steroids. The low relapses tend not to be treated with steroids and have prompt recovery versus kind of leading to some subtle tingling in the fingers and toes, where the medium relapses will have some possible incomplete recovery, meaning that the patient may notice after the relapse that their vision's not quite back to normal. And the high relapses are those we're really concerned about, and that 6 months after the relapse, things are still lagging, and you aren't bouncing back from a relapse the way you usually do. So you would put that dial from that very first slide that's on here to a high. So you're grading the relapses first, and how severe are they, and are patients recovering? Then you're looking at this, not only the severity of the relapses, but the frequency of the relapses, in that you don't want to have a patient relapsing more than once a year or more frequently relapsing than the prior therapy they were on. So if a patient was on something like beta-seron and having a relapse only once a year, went to Avonex, for example, and had two relapses a year, that would be a failure of therapy. So you're looking at the change in pattern of relapses, as well as the fact you don't want patients to relapse more than once a year. And we also have to encourage patients not to declare treatment failure, meaning don't say that what you're on isn't working, based on a single attack or a few months of treatment. So in general, when I start somebody on a medication in January, if they had a relapse in March, I wouldn't say that's a failure of the medication. I would say the medication itself hasn't had a chance to work. Usually we start patients on meds and 6 months later re-MRI them and examine them. If their MRI still shows active disease or inflammation, that could be a sign then at that point that the patient's been on treatment long enough that you would expect to work, that this treatment might not possibly work. You could decide at that point to change therapy already or re-image sooner, like at 3 months, and if a single plaque was there that was new at that point, then consider changing. So you cannot declare treatment failure just based on a single attack only a few months of treatment. And again, like I said, you should definitely consider changing treatments if the relapse is occurring more than once per year or before the treatment even was started. Moving on to the next gauge for how to measure whether your treatment's working is really the MRI. And if you look at the slide, if some of you have them, we look at the MRI and different characteristics. One is we're looking for any enhancement. So we take a picture of your brain without contrast, and then we take a picture with contrast. And the idea is that the blood-brain barrier does not allow contrast usually through to the brain. And if you have any contrast in your brain, that's a sign that inflammation is occurring there that is not being stopped by whatever treatment you're on. So a new enhancing lesion means active inflammation currently occurring when they took that MRI. The next thing is a new T2 lesion, which means a new spot or plaque on the brain that we can see compared to the prior MRI. Or we can see enlarging spots that you previously had that have now gotten bigger. And one of the final ways that we look at things is on another sequence called a T1 sequence, where we look for holes or permanent damage done to the brain or atrophy. So when we look at the brain and say whether or not the therapy is working, to me, if there's active inflammation occurring, meaning gadolinium enhancement, that's a definite sign that things need to be changed or I need to image the patient sooner. If there's possibly just one new T2 lesion, I may be willing to follow the patient more slowly. And again, if patient has a new GAD lesion plus a new T2 lesion, that would be a high-risk patient for me, and I would more likely change them. So the next slide in general, assessing suboptimal response, is you have to realize, both as physicians and patients, that you can develop new spots despite therapy, but the importance is whether or not there's active enhancement, as well as the location of the new spots, as well as how many you're getting at one time. So if you have a single new one, you just can follow. If you have new enhancement plus another single one, you tend to rate it a little bit higher in the scheme. And also, the location is important. Patients with brainstem, meaning lower in the brain, or spinal cord lesions are ranked a little bit higher as far as making their therapies change sooner because those areas are more fine-tuned and patients can have more symptoms from plaques in these areas than up in the brain. So in general, an attack rate of greater than a year or a failure to reduce the relapse rate after a year of being on therapy is one reason that you could be failing your therapy. Another is incomplete recovery from 1 year relapses, new brainstem or spinal cord lesions, inflammation affecting numerous different spots in the neurologic system at the same time, or that you're showing signs of progressive motor or cognitive changes with atrophy on the brain. The next slide just shows the dial system, and basically in our heads we're kind of looking at if all the dials were set at low and we have a low level of concern, that would cause us to change. Two levels at medium or one level at high, just in looking at whether you responded from your relapses, whether your relapses are more frequent, or whether your MRI has become more active. I hope I haven't lost you on that incredibly scientific one. Next is number 8. Why do my symptoms worsen in heat? Going back to kind of a basic question, this was first described in 1890 by a neuro-ophthalmologist named William Uthoff. He used this to diagnose MS patients actually in the 1800s and would diagnose them 80% of the time correctly. It's classic Uthoff's phenomenon is this occurrence of worsening of symptoms when you're hot, and it's classically described as a decrease in your visual acuity or your ability to read with a rise in body temperature, and then when you cool off, things improve back to baseline. Basically, warmth results in certain things called sodium leaving the cell and a thing called potassium entering your cell. When potassium enters a cell, it shortens how long the nerve conduction can occur. And so warmth basically increases these pumps, and so the nerve conduction length is shortened in areas that have been damaged. So basically, you're just short-circuiting things temporarily when you're hot, and then when you cool back off, things can flow normally. It tends to occur in patients with illness, exercising, blow-drying their hair, showering, sunbathing. The main thing to stress is the fact it's not causing damage. I've actually had a couple patients mention to me that physical therapists have said they shouldn't stretch or shouldn't work out because they have MS and could cause damage if they have worsening of their symptoms when they work out, and that's not true. If you can stand the symptoms worsening while you're working out, it's better to exercise than to not exercise. And again, the reason that this occurs is that your basic area that you've had damage with your MS, the pumps there are altered a little bit during warmth, but then go back to normal when you cool off. And this occurs with infection, fatigue, any rise in your body temperature, and can also occur with stress. The next one's a very big question I've had in the last week with new therapies being approved, and it is what new therapies and treatments are being developed. So as many of you know, you have the platform therapies that have been around for a while now. The first was in 1993. It was beta-CRN. The second, Avonex, in 1996. And the third, Rebif, in 2002, of this one type of category called interferons. Interferons are dosed in different regimens, once a week, three times a week, or every other day. The basic mechanism I describe to my patients of how they work is they decrease the peripheral ability to cause inflammation of the white cells, but they also make a big wall between the blood and the brain. Basically, the blood things in the blood should not be able to cross into the blood-brain barrier, and people with MS tend to have this free movement at times of white cells into the brain to be able to cause inflammation. And so I think of interferons as the wall maker, not allowing white cells into the brain to cause damage. Side effects of the interferons include flu-like symptoms, increase in your liver functions, it can affect your thyroid, and it can also cause people prone to depression to be a little worsened in regards to depression. All these things are easily managed with your doctor or nurse practitioners treating your MS. The next is Copaxone. This is glutaramer acetate. This is a peptide that was made to be very similar to to myelin, and so they thought that it would work for MS, and in fact it does. It's a daily injection, and its role is to remodel the immune system, I tell patients. It basically makes your immune system be anti-inflammatory instead of pro-inflammatory. And again, it's a daily injection, which is the main downside, and the site reactions can last a little bit longer than the interferons. That being said, the only other significant side effect is some people have a post-injection reaction where they feel a little chest pressure and tightness that's short-lived and goes away. But if you don't warn patients it can occur, it can be quite scary. The interferons and glutaramer acetate in studies decrease relapse rate by about 30% and MRI activity by 70 to 90%. And these were developed when there was no other therapies for MS patients. And so patients going into it tended to be more progressed in regards to their MS than patients that are currently entering the trials for approval. Another MS therapy that was approved in 2000 was mitoxantrone or navantrone. This is a chemo drug that many of you will not have heard of, but it's the only FDA-approved medication for secondary progressive MS because it showed in a European trial to delay or plateau progression of MS to keep people with secondary progressive MS walking. So we tend to use this in patients that have early secondary progressive MS to plateau their disease so they don't lose the ability to walk independently. It is a significant drug. You can only have a certain dose in a lifetime. It can affect your heart, and it does have a leukemia risk. So it's not something to take lightly, but maybe something a neurologist may talk to you if they think you have any signs of secondary progressive MS. In 2004, Tysabri was approved and then briefly taken off the market. This is a medication called natalizumab. It basically inhibits the white cells from binding to the blood-brain barrier and going across, so it keeps the white cells kind of on the right side of the brain instead of going into the brain. And it has pretty profound benefit in decreasing relapses around 60% and really shutting down MRI activity. And it was rapidly approved by the FDA before trials even finished and then briefly taken off the market because it was found to cause a brain infection called PML, short for progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. Once they had analyzed the data and figured out why patients were getting this, they figured out that it was occurring in people that have another immunosuppressive on board, meaning they were on steroids, Avonex, Rebif, something else that was suppressing their immune system along with the Tysabri. So now we have the regulations that patients that are going on Tysabri cannot be on another immunomodulating therapy or something that suppresses their immune system. The other thing they were able to do is the company that makes it, Biogen, was able to come up with a blood test for us to test patients' blood to see whether they carry the virus that causes the brain infection. Because technically, if you don't have the virus that causes the brain infection in your body, Tysabri should not be risky because you can't get the brain infection. So there's two mechanisms by which we can now streamline who can go on Tysabri, along with making sure that people haven't had prior chemo, which increases the risk of the brain infection. So Tysabri is a very effective and great medication to use in a certain patient population. Next, in 2010, came Gilenya. This is the first oral therapy for MS. Its generic name is fingolimod. It basically binds to certain receptors on white cells, keeping them in the lymph glands, which means to patients that you will not have as many lymphocytes circulating out throughout your blood. So side effects in the trial of Gilenya were it could decrease patients' heart rate, increase their blood pressure, cause a swelling in their eyes, and that swelling, would, if it were to occur, usually happen in the first 3 months. And it could also affect how much air a patient could expel, meaning if you took a deep breath in and breathed out as much as you possibly could, it decreased that number. That being said, patients really were not aware of that as much as they were of the blood pressure and heart rate piece, which usually occurred within the first 6 hours, and patients have to be monitored for the first 6 hours they receive the drug. Since it's been approved, it's become clear that the decreased heart rate and blood pressure issue is more of a big deal. Therefore, patients are having to be monitored with EKGs and vital signs for at least 6 hours when they're first dosed. And it's are also informed they should not be on a certain blood pressure medication so they don't interact with the Gilenya. The other side effects my patients commonly experience for about a month, if at all, is some have diarrhea and some have headache, but these are very tolerable side effects. And the next one that was just approved September 2012 is something called Aubagio, which is generic name is teriflunomide. This medication basically inhibits the, something called pyrimidine, which is something needed for DNA of certain white cells, T and B cells, so thereby it decreases the amount of B and T cells available to attack the nervous system. It was just recently approved based on the TEMSO trial, a large-scale trial that's being done in conjunction with another trial called the TOWER trial. Basically, they're looking at the drug versus placebo, a low and a high dose, 7 milligrams and 14 milligrams versus placebo, and both actually showed statistical significance, the 14 milligram in a few more parameters than the 7 milligram. And again, this is a DNA inhibitor of T and B cells. Thereby, it unfortunately does have some black box warnings, meaning things to watch for, but not because teriflunomide itself caused these, but the parent compound, which is something called leflunomide, which is approved already by the FDA for rheumatoid arthritis in the form of the name of Areva. The parent compound of teriflunomide causes some teratogenic effects in animal models, meaning it can cause birth defects in animal models. Teriflunomide has not been shown to do that. However, because the parent compound did, they had to list this as a possible side effect of the teriflunomide. So again, it was approved September 2012 in two doses, actually, to be dosed, 7 milligrams or 14, depending on which the physician wishes to use. Both doses saw a decreased relapse rate of 30% in patients, equal to the injectables, basically, and decreased new lesions by about 69% on the high dose. The other thing this trial showed was a decrease in disability progression, which is a new marker, because patients care that they don't have relapses and care they don't have MRI activity, but they really want to know they're not going to be disabled long-term on a medication, and this showed a decreased disability progression as well. The side effects we have to watch for physicians are that patients have to have a TB test prior to going on it because they're not going to have as many circulating B and T cells. They have to have a pregnancy test. We have to routinely follow their liver functions, not because of what teriflunomide showed in the trials as much as what the parent compound again shows. There is some diarrhea, nausea possible. But the main two that came out of the trials were that patients could have hair thinning and something called alopecia, which is hair loss, as well as nasopharyngitis, meaning they can have some upper respiratory infections as well. But this has been approved September 2012, and as of October 1st, patients are able to go on this, again, at two doses. Patients often ask, should I change to one of these new therapies? And I often say to them, if your current therapy is working, if you're compliant, and you tolerate the current side effects you have of your medication, then I would not trade that because finding something that works for you is a big deal. But if you're really not compliant and the side effects are affecting your compliance, then it's time to talk about one of these possible oral therapies. I do not encourage patients that are thinking of being pregnant to start teriflunomide, though, however, because of the possible teratogenic effects to babies. Now moving on briefly to the emerging therapies of things that you can watch for that might be coming down the pipeline. The first and most promising, really, is BG12, dimethyl fumarate. It's a medication actually used in Europe a lot for psoriasis. This medication is an oral therapy, and if approved, will be a twice-a-day therapy versus the once-a-day therapies of Gilenya and teriflunomide, or Aubagio, excuse me. In the first phase 2 trial of BG12 in general, works by inducing an anti-inflammatory effect. So basically it works similar to Copaxone in that it shifts from a pro-inflammatory state to an anti-inflammatory state. In a small trial, it showed 69% reduction in new spots on the brain. In a large phase, in two large phase 3 trials versus placebo, meaning versus no drug, it's been very promising. It decreases the relapse rate by 50%, decreases new lesions on the MRI by 70 to 90%, and decreased disability progression in one of the trials by 38%. And interestingly enough, in the two trials, the difference between the two trials was one was twice-a-day dosing and one was three times a day dosing. And there really was no difference between the twice-a-day and the three times a day dosing. And so looking for approval for the twice-a-day dosing, which will make patients be more compliant and not have to worry about a midday dosing. I was part of this trial as well, and I can attest to the fact the main side effects really were some GI upset, meaning diarrhea, and some flushing, some feeling of redness of the face that really occurred for the first couple weeks and then abated. And some patients taking aspirin noticed less of this side effect. This medication is looking very promising, and the company that makes this med is currently trying to get it through the FDA and hopefully to be approved and available in 2013. The next medication, leuquinimod, again works by shifting the immune system to an anti-inflammatory state, so healing inflammation instead of causing it. The phase 2 trials look very promising. It decreased disease on MRI. However, in 2011, when the phase 3 trials, which are the large-scale trials that show benefit for patients, came out, they didn't have statistically significant reduction in relapses compared to placebo, which was a big surprise to the company because the smaller trial looked so promising. The interesting thing is that it did delay disability progression quite significantly. So the company that makes the medication is being asked by the FDA to do a third trial, and they're currently working this out. So that is leuquinimod. The next medication, called alemtuzumab, which is on the top right, is something called a monoclonal antibody binder. Basically, it binds to certain B cells in the blood, not making them available to cause an attack of the nervous system. There's a large trial, one of which was called CAMS, which is C-A-M-M-S, which showed statistically significant benefit of this medication, actually. It's 65% reduced the risk of accumulating disability compared to Rebif. So this trial is one that's talked about a lot because this didn't go against placebo or low-dose interferon. This went against high-dose, already approved Rebif and showed statistical significance over Rebif in reduction in disability, relapses, and MRI activity. And you would wonder why this hasn't been approved, actually, because this trial was completed a number of months ago. And the reason is that it's been shown to have a few side effects that the FDA is trying to sort out with the makers of the drug, in that 30% of patients, roughly, in the trials on alemtuzumab developed thyroid disease. And so basically patients, even though they got these once-a-year infusions of this drug that would help their MS, were developing thyroid disease. And then a small percentage of patients developed a bleeding disorder called ITP. So this is currently much like what Tysabri went through, being regulated as to which patients should go on this. How do we regulate for these side effects? This is a good drug that looks to be approved in 2013 with some tight regulations, making sure we're screening for which patients to put on this. So it won't be one of the ones you'll go to first, but rather would likely go to if you have very aggressive disease or have broken through other disease-modifying therapies. The next drug is daclizumab. It, too, binds to certain B cells. It's a once-a-month injection, and I'm sorry if I didn't say it. Alemtuzumab is approximately once-a-year infusion, actually. It's a very long-acting medication. Daclizumab binds to certain B cells in the blood as well. It's a once-a-month injection. It's currently in very small trials. It's not in large trials yet, and so this is a very early medication just to kind of watch for. In the trials right now, they're running into some issues with liver enzyme elevation and people getting hepatitis, and so they're having some dropouts in the trial from that. So this is currently being sorted out and definitely very, very new in regards to emerging therapies, where you're going to definitely hear a BG12 and alemtuzumab in 2013 and possibly leuquinimod. These next two, you definitely will, it'll be further down the line. Then is ocrelizumab, another thing that binds to certain antibodies. It's approximately twice a year infusion, 2 weeks apart. In a phase 2 trial, it significantly reduced MRI and relapse activity. and is now being done in phase 3 trials to see the same benefit. So this is the early phase 3 trials, large scale number of patients being involved. And the main side effects with ocrelizumab currently being seen in the clinical trials is some flushing and itching if you're on the medication when you're getting the infusion, which can be combated with Benadryl. And it slightly increases your risk of infection because of the fact you won't have as many B cells in your blood, so thereby you'll get colds possibly more frequently that last longer. Next, and hopefully simpler, is what about diet and multiple sclerosis? The main diet research that's been out there is a Swank diet, and it's based on the fact there might be a possible association of MS with dietary fat. And the basis for this is that polyunsaturated fats, the body is completely unable to make. So unsaturated fats we can't make, we have to acquire. And there's two types, basically, omega-3 and 6. And these are the types I often encourage my patients to try and find supplements in. Because omega-3 and 6 are broken down in the body to two things called linoleic acid and alpha-linolenic acid. Basically, the end products of these things are called prostaglandins and leukotrienes. So if you're taking in unsaturated fats and omega-3 and 6, they're broken down to prostaglandins and leukotrienes, which regulate the immune system and other body functions. They basically keep your immune system in check. And I always remind patients, the other place you can get omega-3 and 6 are high leafy green vegetables and fish. So getting back to the Swank diet, it was devised in 1948 and basically focuses on a low intake of saturated fat. Patients were not to get more than 15 grams per day, and the diet was high in polyunsaturated fat, so no red meat for a year, then a small amount was reintroduced in this diet after a year, and a low intake of dairy because it's high in saturated fat. Cod liver oil and multivitamin supplements were part of this diet, and it was very difficult to adhere to for patients because of the fact it was so limited with no red meat, no dairy, and then the cod liver oil piece. The cod liver oil comes from the fact that vitamin D is often deficient in MS patients, and so cod liver oil is high in this. They did publish some data from this diet, actually, in 1990 and 2003, on 144 patients that did the diet for 34 years and 15 patients for 50 years, which is quite significant. And they reported decreased disease severity, decreased death rate, and less frequent and severe attacks. These patients knew what they were on, and there was no placebo arm to it. So it looks very promising, definitely has some good basis to it, and that taking in more inflammatory foods will, in general, you can extrapolate that to more inflammation within the body. And definitely vitamin D is an immune regulator. However, many of us that read the trials recognize that there's no placebo. Clinicians and patients were aware what they were on, and some of the results seem almost too good to be true. So I kind of, along with a lot of MS physicians, extrapolate it to the fact that diet is extremely important with MS. But it's important to eat a variety of foods and choose whole grain cereals and breads to remain regular. Eat fruits and vegetables, obviously. Try to keep fat less than 30% of calories and limit saturated fat is the key. Because saturated fat, again, has a lot of pro-inflammatory markers. Trying to eat fish 2 to 3 times a week, taking a vitamin D supplementation, usually in the range of 2 to 4,000 international units a day, or cod liver oil, and drinking plenty of fluids. There's other diets that are out there that I commonly get asked in clinic as well, which I could open up to questions later and you can ask me. Why am I so tired is number 5. MS fatigue is actually very poorly understood, and it occurs in about 75 to 95% of patients. And many patients feel frustrated because people will say to them, "You look so good," and people outside of them can't see how tired they feel or how much pain they're in. So the first thing when a patient comes to clinic is to try to identify if there's any contributing factors to MS fatigue, meaning you're not sleeping, you're waking up frequently at night due to pain or going to the bathroom, you're actually depressed, or you're just deconditioned where it takes longer to do things, thereby you're more tired. So I always make sure to rule out other medical conditions such as thyroid disease, anemia, any pulmonary diseases, and I also review medications because often the medications that we put you on for symptoms can also cause fatigue, especially the spasticity medications. There is this thing called handicap fatigue, which is that due to increased effort needed to do routine tasks in your home, you just feel overall more tired as well. So breaking down tasks can help fatigue if it's that type of fatigue as well. Once I've ruled out secondary causes and that there's no medication we can decrease or anything different we can do in the patient's lifestyle, I will try medication management. But first focus on avoid deconditioning, making sure that patients are exercising, making sure that patients are planning ahead and breaking tasks up so they're not too insurmountable. Sometimes I have patients work with occupational therapists to come into the home or go into the workplace to see what tasks can be broken down. many times when I switch to medications or start medications, the insurance companies require us to use a lower tier medication before we go to high tier. So I'll often have to go with amantadine, which is a medication that was an antiviral initially, then used for Parkinson's and is now interestingly used for MS fatigue. Works about 50% of the time. It's dosed 100 milligrams twice a day and pretty well tolerated. The main side effects are some nausea, constipation is possible, though rare, and dizziness. Some people feel lightheaded on this medication. If it doesn't work, I'll often go to a stimulant, and if I can, I'll often go to Provigil, which I'll dose 100 milligrams twice a day and sometimes increase to 200 milligrams twice a day. It's very well tolerated. People feel dramatically energized on this medication. The side effects I run into on this one are mainly that if you're prone to headache, you can develop some headache, and patients can also have some palpitations. Ritalin and Xylert are other possibilities, as are Adderall. It all depends on a patient's insurance company and what they'll allow us to use. Sometimes if depression and fatigue are a piece, I go to something like Prozac, Paxil, or Zoloft. Common side effects with this, because of the way they work, are nausea and diarrhea. And some people can have sexual dysfunction, which can already occur if you're depressed, so I try not to use these medications if that's a key piece. Headache, and some rare people get anxiety when they go on an antidepressant. The last thing I didn't mention is that some people are sleeping poorly just because they can't fall asleep. They have racing thoughts. So you can dose sleep aids at night like Ambien or Lunesta, or you can put a patient on Remeron, something that helps anxiety. So it's important to tell your doctor why you think you're fatigued, all the way from it takes longer to do things so it makes you tired to I'm not having restorative sleep. Or if you're having symptoms of restless legs where you're moving your legs a lot at night and your partner's saying you're kicking them a lot at night, that's something to mention to your doctor too, because these symptoms can be treated as well. Will the medicine make my symptoms go away? I think one of the more common things I see is that when I start a patient on therapy for their MS, whether it's Rebif or Tysabri, patients expect the medication to make what's occurring in their body go away. And the real goal for putting someone on disease-modifying therapy, no matter the therapy, is to plateau disease, meaning at that point, the patient, your goal is to not let them have a single new thing on MRI or a single new symptom. The old symptoms, characteristically, a lot of patients feel get better once they're on treatment, but aren't guaranteed to go away. And that's important to realize, that the goal of new therapy is to prevent new symptoms and not to improve existing ones. Relapses in general will improve on their own. I think the ones I see in clinic that take the longest to improve are sensory, and that can be annoying. But these are graded as mild relapses, mind you, because they don't respond to steroids and do eventually get better on their own. But sensory relapses are tough for patients, because if your whole left side of your body is numb and tingly with a relapse, it often won't permanently go away, but rather you'll be left with tingling in the very tips of your fingers and toes, which can be just simply annoying for patients. I do state that longstanding symptoms, usually greater than a year, are really unlikely to 100% resolve, but will fluctuate. This would include things like blurred vision. If your vision's been blurred for up to a year, usually that won't completely go away, or sensory changes. Next is, what is a clinically isolated syndrome? This is a single episode of what appears to be demyelination affecting the CNS, or the central nervous system. Most of the time, a clinically isolated syndrome, that first attack is something called optic neuritis, where a patient has pain behind an eye when they move that eye, or decreased acuity, or it feels like there's a lens over their eye, or a fog. Another one is transverse myelitis, where patients feel a banded tightness around their torso, or Lhermitte's, where they flex their neck forward and they feel a zing through their body. In young people, it can be a first attack of difficulty voiding. They can't go to the bathroom. Whatever it is, it's a first attack that something's attacked, or a first sign that something's attacked your nervous system. And there was a trial called the Optic Neuritis Treatment Trial that helped us get our parameters for diagnosing MS, because technically, a clinically isolated syndrome is that first attack of demyelination to the nervous system. The next step is to predict whether patients are going to go on to have MS and if they should be on therapies, because many of the therapies I've already talked about, namely Copaxone, Avonex, and Betaseron, have been approved for the first attack to prevent patients to go on to develop MS. So the optic neuritis treatment trial showed that if you image or do an MRI on a patient that has the first signs of something attacking their nervous system, and they even have a single spot, just even one spot that's typical for MS on their MRI, their likelihood is high in the next 5 years they'll go on to develop MS. So if someone has optic neuritis by an ophthalmologist and is sent to me now, I will always get a baseline MRI, and I'll be able to tell a patient, here's your risk of going on to MS, and here's what we talk together about whether they want to go on therapy to prevent them from getting MS, or they just want to be watched more closely to see if they develop anything new that would make them go on treatment. We diagnose MS based on two things. One is episode separated in time, meaning 30 days between relapses, and space, meaning two areas of the nervous system involved. The definition of MS is inflammation separated in space and time. So when you've had an attack of optic neuritis, you have your space of your optic nerve. If you have another spot in the brain at the same time, you have a separation in space, and it's only the time component that you're missing upon that first initial optic neuritis diagnosis. MRI is very helpful nowadays and helps us detect 90 to 90% of spots due to MS, so it's very sensitive for us. Next is, how do I maximize my visit with my neurologist? I think this is really important because often you come to clinic and you have all these things you want to bring up and they disappear once you get there. So to maximize the visit, I recommend that between visits, you keep a list, whether it's on the refrigerator or by your toothbrush, of questions and symptoms you're experiencing. The night before or a couple days before, try to bring them together and try to prioritize to see what you definitely want to cover and what is not a big deal any longer. And nothing is too minor to mention. And I think the things that are missed that we try to ask but don't always have time to is alterations in the amount you can do. Can you walk really as far as you used to be able to? Can you do everything you used to be able to? Are you making compensations in different areas, whether it's, you know, a shower chair, not being able to do your checkbook, taking a nap at work, not going to the mall because you can't walk the mall, mentioning home modifications, like I said, memory changes are a big piece, giving over tasks to your partners to do because you can't do them, you know, if colleagues are helping in more at work. And the other thing you have to be very honest and maximize your visit with is how frequently you are missing medications. Because if we think you're doing your medications and we're seeing more frequent relapses or your exam is changing or your MRI is changing, but we believe you've been doing your drug, we're going to say that's a medication failure and switch you. When it may not be a medication failure, but we need to help you be able to use that medication more consistently. And often if we don't think you're compliant, we won't use the same drug in a category, may eliminate a category completely when it is available to you. So just important to be honest. And the last question I get commonly is, how do I manage spasticity? And spasticity is overactivation of muscles. It can cause cramping, stiffness. It can be described as feeling like a rubber band is pulling in your leg. And in MS patients, spasticity is overactivation of the extensors of your legs in general. So your legs want to hyperextend, plantar flex, and invert, meaning they want to stick straight out, flex your toes, and turn internally. So aggravators are things that cause stiffness that I always look for when it's acute or infections. And the most common reason someone has acute spasticity when they normally were normal is a bladder infection they don't know they have, because not every MS patient knows they even have had a bladder infection. So many of my patients will be sent for urinalysis if they describe this. Another thing that's a big trigger is constipation, pain, elevated temperatures, skin breakdown, like ulcers can do this, and overall just relapses or exacerbations. Treatment of spasticity definitely improves fatigue. To not have to fight stiffness all the time improves patients' overall sense of fatigue, increases coordination, and frees movement. So basically, when I first approach spasticity, I try to start with stretching, PT, yoga, and then I'll start with something low tier like baclofen, except if a patient says the only thing they have is cramping at night. Cramping alone, I try to do a kind of a conservative management and try to have patients first try tonic water. Tonic water has something interesting in it called quinine that affects muscle spasms. So if you drink a glass of tonic water with each meal and sometimes at bedtime, it can block those cramps from happening, and then you won't need a medication that can be sedating. If tonic water is not tolerated or is not working, then I go to baclofen. You can dose baclofen up to 120 milligrams per day. I usually start with when the patient's having cramps, which is often at the end of the day, so I'll start with it a dose at night. And you can slowly increase it. You can start 10 milligrams three times a day and slowly increase it as you need to. If patients don't tolerate baclofen, reach the peak dose, and they're still not having benefit, I will add something called Xanaflex, which is a muscle relaxant. Usually I'll dose that 4 milligrams at night, and it will assist with loosening the muscles while patients sleep so they don't feel so tight in the morning. And my third option usually is actually something called Dantrolene, which basically does not allow calcium to trigger the muscles as much. You do have to make sure you follow the liver functions on this medication, as well as make sure they're not on other medications that do the same thing. You can dose this 3 times a day or 4 times a day, but you can't go over 100 milligrams per day. Sometimes patients only have cramping of a calf or just one arm. And so the thing I can do if it's just a one part of their body cramping is I often do Botox injections, where you can just weaken the muscle that's causing the cramp that overall improves fluidity then, because if your calf is tight, then that makes you not be able to pick up your toes as well. If I inject your calf, that'll allow the calf to be a little bit weaker so then you can pick up your toes. It's basically balancing out the extensor and flexor compartments by focused Botox injections rather than putting medications in that affect you systemically. And when all oral therapies have failed and a patient doesn't just have focal stiffness of a muscle, we do have things called baclofen pumps we can implant, where there's something placed subcutaneously under your skin and your abdomen that has a small catheter that goes into your cord that slowly releases baclofen that allows for allows for stiffness to decrease in the legs as well. It is an invasive procedure, but can bring significant benefit to patients that are having a lot of tone problems in their legs. I know this is a lot of information. I usually expect people to retain about 25%, so I appreciate all your attention, and now I'm just going to open it up for questions.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your phone. The first question is from Jennifer Dempsey. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Appleby. I've been diagnosed newly about 2 or 3 months ago, but for the last maybe 5 years, I've been, you know, aware that this was the possibility of a diagnosis.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm sure stress comes into play with a lot of the symptoms I'm experiencing, you know, because of the news. I'm noticing things more now than I did in the past before my diagnosis. But one thing I'm noticing is a stiffness in the neck. And I think in past visits to my neurologist, he's asked me about various aches and pains, and that may have been one of them. So I'm wondering if that falls in line with what you're talking about with spasticity, and if so, what I can maybe do to try to alleviate some of that pain and tension before my next appointment with my doctor.
You know, stiffness in the neck is not spasticity in general. I have had, so stiffness in the neck can be a lot of different things that aren't MS. It can be, you know, arthritis. It can just be muscle tension that's held there. So I usually treat stiffness in the neck in MS patients like it's muscle tension more than it's anything else. And so I usually use a very low-dose muscle relaxant at night for something like that, like Xanaflex 2 milligrams or baclofen 10 milligrams. And if patients don't want medications, I usually have them do heat at nighttime on their neck and some range of motion. I don't know if that's helpful, though.
Okay, the next question is from Howard. Please go ahead.
Hi. Referring to page 2 of the handout, on the you had some gauges there on suboptimal responders.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little confused about it. A suboptimal responder, I guess, is somebody who will not respond to medications. You have to make a change. What's confusing to me is that the gauges are all on low, so I would assume that if they're on low, that you're really not in a bad flare or a bad situation. That's where I'm confused.
Yeah, I kind of struggled with whether to hand out the handout or trying to explain it. So all those gauges should be set at zero. So if you look at that page, which would be page 5 if you actually have the handout in front of you, and I just recently started releasing handouts like this, so I apologize if it's not clear, but in general, all those gauges should be set at zero. And so if one is at low, you're not worried, and the rest are at zero, you're not worried. If all three are at low, you do worry. If one is at medium, you worry. Or if one is at, I mean, they all should be at zero. So, and as a doctor, all our gauges when a patient walks in are set at zero and slowly increase to low, medium, or high, depending on what we're seeing. So if you take that page and you go to the very last one of that section that I talked about, it'll explain to you that if all three gauges were at low, that'd be a big deal to us. That means there's three different things that are affecting us and making us think of changing. If two gauges are at medium, we'll change, and if one gauge was high, we would change. So all gauges should be set at zero, and then you kind of go up as you see the patient.
Okay, the next question is from Jane. Please go ahead.
Hi. I have severe pain throughout many areas of my body. I take Tylenol 4, which is codeine. I was wondering, is there any other non-addictive pain medication? I do not have drowsiness from codeine or constipation, but I have a lot of fatigue and insomnia. I'm just wondering, is there some pain medication that could help the pain without being addictive, like oxycodone or something? I don't want anything that strong. But is there anything else that could help pain?
I mean, that's a tough one, having not seen you, because if you have diffuse body pain from MS, I usually use nerve medications more than I use pain medications. So I use things like Lyrica and gabapentin and Cymbalta, which can also give some, Cymbalta can give a little energy plus help pain and is non-addictive, as are Lyrica and Neurontin. So I usually use nerve medications or Cymbalta, like I said, for nerve pain and MS pain more than I will use narcotics or other pain medications. You know, the other thing is Celebrex is non-addictive. It's an anti-inflammatory. Ultram is another one that's non-addictive.
Okay, the next question is from Mary. Please go ahead.
You mentioned earlier in your explanation to us about constipation. Could you go over that again, what you were looking for there?
I'm sorry, what?
You were pointing out things that you were looking for, and one of them was constipation. And I didn't track all you were saying, so could you go over that again?
I'm not sure what I was talking about, because I mentioned constipation a couple times. But constipation, what I was trying to say is constipation can worsen stiffness and spasticity. And so if a patient's having a lot of stiffness, I make sure that they're not constipated, because if you can get patients' bowels removing regularly on a daily basis, you can decrease the likelihood that they're going to be as stiff. The other place I mentioned constipation is that it can be caused by numerous medications, like the bladder medications. And the other place I mentioned constipation is when a very young person has a lot of constipation, it can be one of the earlier signs of MS that's being missed.
Okay, the next question is from Howard. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Doctor. This is Howard May, and the question I have is that frequently there are old people who have had MS for a long time, and the only secondary progressive type of medication that you mentioned was Tysabri. Are there any other therapies that you recommend for people who have any kind of secondary progressive?
So the only approved medication isn't Tysabri for secondary progressive, but it's mitoxantrone or navantrone. So if I see somebody that has early secondary progressive, my train of thought with them usually is I will give them a short course of Tysabri possibly, see if I can get anything out of that. After 6 months, if I don't, I'll consider mitoxantrone. That's the only FDA-approved medication for secondary progressive MS. Off-label, there's other things I do try for secondary progressive MS. And one of the first things I usually try is steroids. So I'll try 3 days of IV steroids in a row for a patient, and then I'll do once a month IV steroids, just one day. And some people, like 25% of secondary progressive MS patients, feel a benefit from that. And the other off-label thing I sometimes try is something called methotrexate, which is a chemo drug you can take twice a week orally that can plateau disease in some very small trials, but it hasn't been shown to be efficacious enough for the FDA to approve. So the only approved therapy is mitoxantrone. I do try Tysabri early on in some patients, but I usually either try IV steroids or methotrexate. But there are a lot of research trials being done right now in vaccination studies for secondary progressive patients, as well as oral therapies for secondary progressive, because that's the area that people are looking at now, because we have so much relapse remitting, they feel like they need to make more progress on the progressive forms of MS.
Okay, the next question is from Diane. Please go ahead.
Hi, I have really, really enjoyed this. And I was wondering if this is being taped and if we could obtain a CD to hear it again.
I don't actually know if it's being taped. I'll have to ask the MS Society person when we get to the end here.
This was very informative, and I think
I really didn't
have a question. I'd just like to hear it again.
Oh, sure.
I could go over what you said, and I was hoping there would be a CD. But anyway, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Is my line live?
Yes, Ms. Watkins, it is.
Oh, thanks. This is Amy from the MS Society. I just want to interject that, yes, this is being recorded. It will be available for download on our website, or you could request a CD be made and sent to you. So you'll contact your chapter, and that should be available within the next couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Okay, the next question in queue is from Dennis. Please go ahead.
Hello, doctor.
Hi.
I'm trying to find out. I have a severe problem with my walking, and
yeah.
have some stiffness in my fingers. My right side is a little stiff, and I've been taking the Empower for roughly a little less than a month.
Mm-hmm.
Would you recommend seeing a chiropractor to maybe alleviate some of the problems I'm having with walking, or what would you recommend?
So you just mentioned your hand, and that's one thing I forgot to mention in the teleconference tonight is that Ampryra is another medication that we use for stiffness and spasticity because it helps prolong action potentials in muscles, so it can help muscle weakness in walking. So I'm glad you actually called in to mention that because there's certain patients that for stiffness and for weakness you can use a medication called Ampryra 10 milligrams twice a day. But you just mentioned stiffness of your hand. So do you have stiffness of your legs too? I don't know if he's
hard
still on the line.
Balanced and things like that.
What did you say?
It's hard to keep balanced.
Okay.
And there's not too much stiffness, but in my fingers I feel really stiff. It's like almost an arthritis kind of feel.
Yeah. So I don't, you know, you'll know if there's going to, if your Ampere is going to help you, it will help you in the first 3 months of being on it. And if not, you don't necessarily need to be on it anymore because it will only help you. You'll know if it's going to work if it works in the first 3 months. But for people that have a lot of balance and stiffness problems, more than chiropractors, I send them to physical therapists and have them do balance and core retraining. So for you, I'd recommend if balance is your main issue with some joint stiffness, a chiropractor is not going to probably do it as much as a physical therapist would do it for you.
Okay, and the next question is from Marianne. Please go ahead.
Hello, doctor. I was wondering what you thought of Ann Romney's comment that she is in remission of her MS because I've had MS for 2 years. And a lot of times because I look fine, like you said, people will say, oh, you're in remission, or you're like my friend who has a touch of MS. There cannot be such a thing. Am I wrong that that's why you go on the therapy as soon as you're diagnosed with a clinically isolated syndrome?
I mean, I think what Ms. Romney is saying is that she is in between, you know, that she's currently not having an active flare. So I think, you know, when you have relapse remitting MS, you're either in a relapse or you're in remission. You're not in both or either. You're not in both at the same time. So when you're on medication, the idea is if you're on medication, that you should be, you want to be in a state of remission, meaning that nothing's going on except your baseline symptoms. You don't want to be in amongst a relapse. So when she said that comment, I interpreted it that she's on medication, it's working, and she's currently not having anything new going on.
Okay, the next question is from Pamela. Please go ahead. Hello, Pamela. Your line is open. Did you have a question?
I apologize. I put my phone on mute. I sort of blanked out a little bit around question three, and that's where I have my question. And it's, what is a clinically isolated syndrome?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not entirely sure what this question meant. And when I look at the answer, I remember you speaking about transverse myelitis, and I'm not sure if you were saying that transverse myelitis might be a beginning symptom of MS. Are you saying that that is a possibility?
Yes.
So, yes, it is it always a possibility?
Transverse myelitis, it's always a possibility. There's about there's a way for us to differentiate that. So I don't know if your initial attack was transverse myelitis, but in general, people that have complete transverse myelitis, meaning both sides of their body were affected the same, are less likely to go on and have MS, and those that have only part of their body affected. So people with complete transverse myelitis, very symmetric bilateral involvement of their body, are not likely to go on to have MS. People that have asymmetric, one side more affected than the other side when they have transverse myelitis, are more likely to. So we do screen when patients have transverse myelitis. We do brain MRIs as well as image the rest of their spine to make sure they don't have any inflammation anywhere else that could be a sign of active MS. So it can be the first isolated attack.
Okay, the next question is from Eileen. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Appleby. My name is Eileen. I'm a 68-year-old female. The first time I had any problems was at 18. I lost the vision in my left eye, and then at 19, I saw double, and nothing until my mid-30s when I had peripheral neuritis. The whole left side of my body was numb, and then not an episode again until I was 65, and at that time, I had numbness again, and my MS is not visible to people because I have a lot of numbness and fatigue, and I do have balance issues. But I had what happened to me a few months ago, I had, which was extremely painful, dystonic posturing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In both of my legs.
Mm-hmm.
And my doctor gave me a script for baclofen, but I'm not really taking it as a preventive because I don't like to – I take so much different medications. But I was curious about this tonic water you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Would this be good for it? Because that's not a medication. It's something I would be willing to try.
You know, dystonic posturing, I usually use seizure medications for because they work really well, but it sounds like yours is intermittent enough where tonic water could help it because tonic water helps for spasms quite well if you consistently do it. So you just drink a cup or a glass with each meal and then at bedtime, and the consistency of doing it for 5 days can really help and be a natural way to cure spasms and cramps.
Okay, the next question is from Hillary. Please go ahead.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
Can you just clarify something you said in the second half? I apologize, I missed the first half. You mentioned that somebody who could be put on Copaxone after being diagnosed with MS, my husband was diagnosed by having a symptom, and they found I think, two or three scarring sections in his brain, but you said something about if someone's put on MS, on Copaxone, that it's not to treat the MS, but to keep the MS from coming, even?
Nope.
Tell
so I was trying to talk about, like, basically I was talking about when patients are put on therapy for MS, like Copaxone, Rebif, it is to prevent new symptoms or plaques from happening. It's not to heal what's already, it can't change the symptoms someone's already have. So if your husband had numbness, it can't change the previous numbness. The goal of starting a therapy is to keep patients from having new symptoms or new plaques. It's just to make the point that a lot of patients think that once they go on therapies, they're going to feel completely better. And that's not the case, and it's often disappointing for patients unless you're honest and say, this is to keep anything new from happening, but what's already present might not go away.
Okay, the next question is from Lyle. Please go ahead.
I'll just contact my local MS office because I was late and I don't have a syllabus and I didn't have a handout, so I was hoping to obtain those materials.
Okay.
Yep, contact your MS office and they will have that.
Okay, and the next question is from Mark. Please go ahead.
Doctor, I'm a 47-year-old male who was just diagnosed in the last month. I've had very, very minor symptoms, but it led to an MRI, which was not very favorable. So I have one very short, specific question, which is somebody with very minor symptoms diagnosed at age 47, are they likely to have the same sort of progression that a younger person would have? And then the second question is more general. You mentioned very briefly the Swank diet, and in my months I've done quite a bit of reading about diet and have read about the MS recovery diet, the Overcoming MS diet by Dr. Jelinek in Australia, the Walls diet, and I'm trying to debate, which I very quickly have gone to a version of the Swank diet, and I'm wondering your perspective on these other diets, which you mentioned there's quite a few other diets, and you might comment further in the Q&A.
So I've read, I get sent probably weekly on by email from a patient different diets, and so I've read the diet out of Iowa and the Australian diet and the Swank diet. I think the one that I stress to patients probably the most consistently is probably a variation of the Swank diet, as I mentioned, which is I really think there is something to us taking in so many inflammatory foods. And so I really do focus on an as unsaturated diet as you can possibly have, recognizing that you have to allow yourself some leeway for just to have normal life. And then I definitely focus on the vitamin D component because there's true data, which I didn't talk about tonight because there's not enough time, showing that if you are on a vitamin D supplement and you don't have MS, it decreases your risk of inheriting or getting MS by 40%. But if you have MS and you're on vitamin D, it decreases the relapse severity as well as how long you have relapses, and it also helps regulate your immune system. So all of my patients are on roughly 2,000 to 4,000 units a day. So I focus kind of on a variation of the Swank, which is an unsaturated fat, plenty of water, avoiding dairy as much as possible. And many of my patients are also gluten-free, but also focusing on the vitamin D component. It's hard for me to speak for the without looking at your MRI. Every patient's so different in regards to the age they present. I think the thing I can say to you is that if you got diagnosed when you had mild symptoms and very little plaque activity and get on therapy fast, your outcome is likely to be very good. The other thing is that, I mean, studies have shown if you get on therapy, the sooner you get on, the better, and now there's so many available, the likelihood of you having aggressive MS is a lot lower these days. And it is true that the milder the symptoms with the initial attack, the better prognosis, but that's not always the case. I tell patients it's hard to read online because each patient writes their own story, and I let patients write their own story. And in the scheme of all the medications available and what you describe, I think you'll do very well, but not having your MRI, it's a little bit hard to talk to the very first question.
Okay, the next question is from Christine. Please go ahead.
Yes, you've mentioned the diet and state of inflammation. Do you know much about food sensitivity testing and how accurate that is as far as determining what foods should be a part of your diet?
Honestly, no, I don't. I have a ton of patients that do food sensitivity diet, especially the newly diagnosed. My newly diagnosed will go right to a nutritionist and a naturopath and get a lot of sensitivities checked. I will say many of them are, I would say 90% of them are tested and are sensitive to gluten, sensitive to wheat, sensitive to dairy. And whether they're tested or not, many of my patients, whether they have MS or have pre-MS or don't have MS, everybody feels better on gluten-free diets. And I think it's just the lack of carbs in their diet. But I don't have a ton of information on the sensitivity of food sensitivity testing. I will say a lot of patients do it. Some are very strict about it, but it usually falls to the wastebasket after a couple of years, and they basically just focus on the vitamin D exercise because the stringent food criteria otherwise gets to be too much for them.
The next question is from Thomas. Please go ahead. Thomas, your line is open. Did you have a question?
Yes. Can you hear me? Hello?
Okay,
yes, I can hear you.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, okay. My question is, since the nervous system predominantly is affected, the nervous system throughout the body is affected by MS, are there any special considerations that need to be taken when a person needs to get anesthesia for surgery, open heart surgery in particular?
No, there's not. You know, there's nothing with anesthesia that's important with MS. It's more the fact that when a patient has surgery and they're trying to heal from their surgery, they kind of have a flare of their baseline symptoms because their immune system kind of surges in order to heal what's going on with their body.
Okay. Operator, do we have a lot of questions left in the queue or just a couple?
Actually, there's still about 6 or 7 in the queue.
How late do you want to go, Dr. Appleby? Do you want to just do 1 or 2 more? Do you want to?
Yeah,
do
can
all...
I just take 1 or 2 more?
That would be fine, yep.
Okay, the next question will be from Melanie. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. My question pertains to the black box warning for Aubagio, and are there any of the therapeutics that are safe to take during pregnancy?
The only one that's pregnancy category B is Copaxone. I guess the point I would make to you is that the other injectables are pregnancy category C, but the difference with the black box warning on Aubagio is the fact it is pregnancy category X, meaning it has known teratogenic effects that happened in its precursor molecule in animals, or the others did not have that.
Okay, and the last question will be from Lisa. Please go ahead.
Hi, yes. How common is it for a patient to come in at a late stage? I'm 57 years old, and I was just diagnosed in February with
primary progressive?
Thank you. Is it secondary or
No. It's primary progressive. The age of primary progressive patients presenting is about 50.
It is. I mean, I've had many different symptoms through the years, but nobody ever diagnosed me with MS because I never had an MRI, never had a doctor that was, I guess, astute enough to notice that it might have been MS. So now I'm 57 and I have primary progressive MS, and I guess a lot of my options are gone now.
Yeah, that is really hard. Your history, I mean, I don't have you in front of me, but your history is that more of kind of a relapse, meaning probably secondary progressive course if you had stuttering symptoms. But there is a variation I don't talk about much tonight called primary progressive MS, which is rarer, but is people usually, men a little bit more than women, in their 50s that present initially kind of with stiffness of the legs, kind of one more than another, feeling like their legs are going to give out, and some bowel and bladder symptoms, versus the patients with relapsing remitting that go on to have secondary progressive without treatment, where it's stuttering symptoms over time and they begin to have more and more difficulty doing things.
Okay, well, I apologize to anybody who did not get a chance to ask their question this evening. I encourage you to please send your question to your MS Society chapter liaison, and if we or one of our INR specialists can't answer it, we can maybe even ask Dr. Appleby to answer if there's any that are difficult, but we will try to get you an answer to your question. And thank you so much, Dr. Appleby. I hope everyone enjoyed the call tonight. It was great. Thank you so much. This series continues on November 28th with a teleconference on invisible symptoms and on December 12th with MS, A Family Affair. Contact your chapter to register for these teleconferences. Please stay on the line to answer 5 quick questions about this program. Your input helps us to better meet your needs in the future. So if you hold on, the operator will tell you how to answer these 5 quick questions by pressing your dial.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this now begins our polling session. In response to the following statements, you may press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion or does not apply. For the first statement, I learned at least one new thing about MS. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion or does not apply. I learned at least one new thing about MS. 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion or does not apply. Polling is now closed for this question. Please hold while we prepare the next question. For the next question, I learned at least one new thing about ways to manage MS symptoms. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion or does not apply. I learned at least one new thing about ways to manage MS symptoms. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion or does not apply. Polling is closed for this question. Please hold while we prepare the next question. For the next question, I plan to use the information I learned during this call to make at least one positive change in the way I manage my MS. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion. I plan to use the information I learned during this call to make at least one positive change in the way I manage my MS. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion. Polling is closed for this question. Please hold while we prepare the next question. For the next question, I learned at least one fact about MS that I want to discuss with a healthcare provider. Press 1 to agree, 2 to disagree, or 3 for no opinion. I learned at least one fact about MS that I want to discuss with a healthcare provider. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion. Polling is closed for this question. Please hold while we prepare the last question. For the last question, I am more likely to register for other teleconferences because I like this learning format. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion. I am more likely to register for other teleconferences because I like this learning format. Press 1 for agree, 2 for disagree, or 3 for no opinion. This concludes our polling session, and this concludes your call for this evening. Thank you all for your participation. And thank you to Dr. Appleby and to the National MS Society. You may all
thank
disconnect.
You, everyone.